Individuals with kidney or heart problems could throw off their electrolyte balance, leading to organ failure. Those with previous surgeries, hemorrhoids, diverticulitis, or other GI problems risk perforating the bowel, a serious complication that can lead to death. And, of course, since colonics are rarely performed in legitimate medical settings, especially DIY administration, there's a risk of using improperly sterilized equipment, which may have the opposite effect of its intended benefit, a raging infection. I don't know about you, but I'm not willing to risk dying on a poop machine in an effort to rid my body of vague toxins that my own biology is pretty good at taking care of on its own. Aubrey's holistic doctor also uses a diagnostic tool known as iridology. I hadn't heard of such a thing until I met Aubrey, and for good reason. Iridology was debunked almost immediately after it came to be, in 1893. As discussed in the chapter on pseudoscience and the demarcation problem, this so-called method was formulated based on a single observation and has never produced an iota of evidentiary support. It fully mimics phrenology, except instead of bumps on the head, practitioners equate markings in the iris with all manner of medical complaints. It's pure pseudoscience, plain and simple, yet Aubrey swears by it. Her obsession with fitness borders on mania. She once exerted herself so hard in a CrossFit gym that she developed rhabdomyolysis. Dubbed rhabdo for short, this is a life-threatening medical condition characterized by cola-colored urine, compartment syndrome, dangerously high pressure buildup impeding blood flow, and muscle pain and weakness. Rhabdo occurs when skeletal muscle is damaged so severely it breaks down inside the body, sending myoglobin and other muscle constituents throughout the bloodstream. Because the body isn't accustomed to such large molecules floating around, they can clog up the kidneys, leading to severe dehydration, kidney failure, paralysis, and even death. When your obsession with health is in and of itself unhealthy, it's time to take a step back and rethink your approach. Perhaps one of the worst offenders in this category is Gwyneth Paltrow, although there sure are others. Her lifestyle website, Goop, is a regular source for Aubrey's nonsense. She advocates for vaginal steaming and vaginal eggs made of jade. Yes, you are to wear these things inside yourself, a practice gynecologists have vehemently condemned. She sells an entire line of unproven supplements, and she regularly promotes detox cleanses, colon cleansing, and homeopathy. She erroneously claims, through her experts, that underwire bras cause breast cancer, and that chemical-based sunscreens, isn't everything chemical-based, cause hormone disruptions. They do not. Gwyneth Paltrow's advice is not only misguided, it's outright dangerous, as Timothy Caulfield, author of Is Gwyneth Paltrow Wrong About Everything?, points out. Yet Aubrey and others can't get enough. The list of Aubrey's wooey approaches to health and wellness is extensive. Chiropractic, acupuncture, chelation therapy, vaccine denialism, etc., etc. But it all stems from a similar place. My friend Aubrey does not trust the mainstream medical establishment. Aubrey is smart. Aubrey is educated. Aubrey is well-read, although I often question her echo chamber reading material. Yet Aubrey thinks that the healthcare system doesn't have our best interests at heart. She doesn't trust allopathic doctors or the Western scientific establishment as a whole, yet she cherry-picks when and how she chooses to apply established evidence-based reasoning to her life. You'd better believe she took antibiotics when she got a raging urinary tract infection. But the yeast infection that followed was, quote, treated with a vaginal mask made of yogurt and kefir. I once pleaded with her that if she ever got cancer, she seek chemotherapy or any treatment her oncologist recommends. She said she couldn't promise she would. I was devastated. Aubrey displays an awful lot of motivated reasoning, and truth be told, it's hard not to get caught up in this kind of thinking in Los Angeles. This sprawling metropolis has a long and rich history of healers, gurus, and even cult leaders duping the populace for financial gain and personal glory. The cognitive biases are so overwhelming in many of the city's residents, they are more likely to listen to Dr. Oz than their own licensed, board-certified physicians. And instead of a $25 copay, they'll shell out hundreds for bogus therapies promising a longer life and more youthful appearance. Maybe it's the same motivation that brings millions of young hopefuls to the city to pursue their dreams that ultimately victimizes them at the hands of duplicitous hucksters. Of course, not everyone in Los Angeles is rich and famous and credulous. We have the largest population of unsheltered homeless people in the country. Our residents are extremely diverse, ethnically, financially, and cognitively. Many Angelenos live a perfectly normal life, but I'm not talking about those people. I'm talking about Hollyweird, land of the privileged, pretty, and credulous. Narcissism is a real bitch. Chapter 43, The Singularity, Bob's Adventure. Clearly, unless thinking beings inevitably wipe themselves out soon after developing technology, extraterrestrial intelligence could often be millions or billions of years in advance of us. We're the galaxy's noodling newbies. Seth Shostak. I am an ardent technophile. Technology is the most fascinating byproduct of human culture and cognition to me. In a lot of ways, I'm also a recovering techno-optimist. The possibilities and allure of future technology can leave me giddy with anticipation. Techno-optimism can also make it easy to expect major advances unrealistically soon, or to dismiss the complexity and time frames of interacting variables involved in bringing us these new tools and devices. It's a constant struggle to temper my enthusiasm enough to allow for a less biased, more realistic assessment of when we could expect today's science fiction to become tomorrow's science. So what are the common missteps that many people take when crystal balling the rise of revolutionary future science and technology? People overestimating near future technology and underestimating the deeper future is a truism that rarely disappoints. Even as few as 20 years ago, I confidently imagined that we'd surely have commuter jetpacks and flying cars by today's date. Yet almost no one going back many decades foresaw the emergence and transformative power of the Internet. Prognosticators are also fond of underestimating the full sweep of changes that can be wrought by new technology and just time. Early 20th century depictions of the future show reasonably extrapolated flying cars, but they're being ridden by quaint people wearing spats and holding canes and feathered parasols. Today we see a near-term future of autonomous cars being shared by everyone, since cars are often idle in garages and parking lots. Seems reasonable, but the notion of sharing cars may turn out to be as much of an anachronism as wearing a monocle while flying a jetpack. Perhaps people will love spending time in cars once they're free to do anything from sleeping to socializing to Netflix binging to having sex. They may then want to own their own cars so they can customize them to their unique tastes and hobbies. This could lead to cars ballooning in size beyond all current expectations. In the 2002 movie Minority Report, for example, a compelling vision of the near future, they imagined we would have tiny cell phones. This was a reasonable extrapolation from the trend in the 1990s. They completely missed the smartphone revolution, however, that led to bigger and bigger phones to maximize screen size. Perhaps the most pernicious pitfall for predictors is called wishcasting. Meteorologists came up with this term after they noticed that weather forecasters predict with an unrealistic frequency that the 4th of July will be sunny and Christmas Day will be snowy. People have a strong tendency to let conscious or unconscious desires influence their predictions. Anticipating and expecting anthropomorphic robot maids and butlers like Rosie from the Jetsons has a history and an undeniable appeal. The appeal is so great that many people just assume it will happen and then build their prediction around that assumption. That metal man in a tux may never actually clean your house, however. Today we have disc-shaped Roomba doing the vacuuming. In the future, cooking may be done by robotic arms attached to the ceiling, with no legs or torso required. Beds may be self-making, please, please, please. there are no foregone conclusions when it comes to the future. Most often, imagining the actual bit of futuristic technology itself is the easy part. The specific implementation of that technology and, more importantly, how people decide to use it are so contingent and unpredictable that they are the downfall of many visions of the future. If you told people in 2000 that we would be texting rather than video chatting, you would have likely been ridiculed. With those caveats firmly in mind, let's look at one of the more controversial and game-changing predictions about the future, the technological singularity. The term, quote, singularity, has many different meanings in many fields of science. In mathematics, it's a point that is undefined or behaves erratically. A gravitational singularity is a point of mind-numbing density producing infinite tidal forces. A mechanical singularity is a mechanism that has inherently unpredictable future states. The technological singularity is similar, a disruptive and unpredictable change of massive proportions. The technological singularity is described with different nuances by different people, but many would agree that it is a hypothetical future point in human history in which an intelligence explosion caused by an artificial superintelligence, ASI, or augmented human minds changes civilization so rapidly that prediction beyond that point becomes inherently infeasible. One of the first hints of the concept of such a singularity came in 1958 from famous mathematician John von Neumann, as quoted by his friend Stanislaw Ulam. One conversation centered on the ever-accelerating progress of technology and changes in the mode of human life, which gives the appearance of approaching some essential singularity in the history of the race, beyond which human affairs, as we know them, could not continue. Another conceptual pioneer was I.J. Goode. He was a British mathematician and cryptologist who also worked with mythic computer scientist Alan Turing. It is Goode who originated the concept of an intelligence explosion with the following quote. Let an ultra-intelligent machine be defined as a machine that can far surpass all the intellectual activities of any man, however clever. Since the design of machines is one of these intellectual activities, an ultra-intelligent machine could design even better machines. There would then unquestionably be an intelligence explosion, and the intelligence of man would be left far behind. Thus, the first ultra-intelligent machine is the last invention that man need ever make, provided that the machine is docile enough to tell us how to keep it under control. This outcome stems from an initial critical juncture in this entire scenario, the creation of an artificial general intelligence. It doesn't have to be smarter than a human, but being in the ballpark of humanity is probably best. From there, simply speeding up the computational substrate is all that would be needed to accomplish superhuman feats. Imagine a human-level artificial intelligence, AI, being able to spend 10 years on a single task. Now imagine if those 10 years of work can be accomplished in one work week. What if that task was the improvement of its own mind, to rewrite or reorganize the foundation of its very cognition? Many more options would obviously be available to such a digital mind beyond those available to a PhD-earning human. We've already discussed overclocking the brain, but what about adding the equivalent of millions more digital neurons to the artificial prefrontal cortex? What about doubling the number of connections in the connectome, the map describing the 100 trillion neuronal interconnections that make up the human biological brain? Either of these strategies, or others, could reasonably produce an intelligence smarter than any human could possibly be. The moment we start down that road, the fuse to an intelligence explosion has been lit. Once this occurs, the process of recursive self-improvement could quickly produce minds twice as smart as the cleverest human, then 10 times smarter. As this happens and unanticipated insights are forged and paradigm shifts start shifting, the, quote, prediction horizon of our culture starts shrinking. At this moment in 2018, we can confidently predict advances that are likely or possible in the near future. say in 15 or 20 years. It's certainly hazy, but I'm pretty certain that many cars on the road could be autonomous in that time. However, we certainly won't be getting into our cars and scooting to the moon in 20 years. The smarter these ever-improving AIs become, the closer our prediction horizon gets. Within a short period of time, looking beyond 1 year into the future will be utterly hopeless. Then 6 months, then perhaps mere hours, and finally, when we've lost all hope of predicting any of the future, the technological singularity will have arrived. I always liked Ray Kurzweil's description of the singularity as technological change so rapid and profound it represents a rupture in the fabric of human history. This, of course, makes sense, because when a mind hundreds or thousands of times more intelligent than anyone starts running the show, how can mere humans anticipate anything that it would do or could discover? To reassert our former power of prediction, one would have to be as intelligent as the AI. You may be wondering, then what? Of course, by definition, we can't predict the answer to that, but we can go over all the extreme possibilities that our meager meat minds can muster. Our artificial superintelligence can conceivably care for and respect all life. It could work with humanity to improve our condition in innumerable ways, curing disease, vastly extending lifespans, making our entire solar system habitable, or even uplifting us to superintelligence as well, if we so desire. This is the benevolent artificial superintelligence scenario imagined in Neil Asher's Polity science fiction universe. Highly recommended, by the way. The other end of the spectrum is not fun. An entity a million times smarter than us could see humanity as V'ger saw Captain Kirk and his crew in Star Trek The Motion Picture, as a carbon infestation that needs to be ignored if we're lucky or, more likely, wiped out. Listing the other examples of this dystopian ASI scenario in culture would exceed the recommended word count for this audiobook. So what do you think of this technological singularity now? Is this all nonsense? Merely the rapture of the nerds, as it's been called? Or is the clamor that's been rising up around this idea becoming increasingly justified? Is even that a false dichotomy? Some disagree with the very premise that a sentient intelligence can be created artificially, digitally, non-biologically. I call this squishy bio-chauvinism. There's no reason to think that wetware or electrochemistry are the only mediums that could support any of the innumerable types of intelligences that could potentially exist. Many theorists of mind subscribe to a functionalist view in which the organization and self-interaction of the brain are more important than the material substrate itself. Many different non-biological substrates could potentially support what we would describe as a mind. Consider this. What if we had a process to slowly convert each of the neurons in your brain into an electronic digital device that precisely mimics their inputs and outputs? After a period of time, your brain would be completely non-biological. Assuming the technology functions as described, would there come a time during the transformation when self-awareness started fading away or stopped completely? Would you become a philosophical P-zombie that behaves normally but without experiencing the rich inner life, the qualia each of us enjoys, and assumes others enjoy as well? Is there something completely undiscovered or unhinted at in neuroscience that allows only biological neurons and nothing else to produce the epiphenomenon of mind? Aside from whether it is possible to replicate sentience, there is also the question of whether we should even try. Now, we're aware that ASIs could present an existential risk. Perhaps we won't let that genie out of the bottle. We've seen in the past decade that narrowly focused, non-self-aware AI can still achieve a great many goals, and we've only scratched the surface of what even this limited AI can do. We don't necessarily need robots and appliances that have fully formed minds. It's not ethical to create minds anywhere near human level or higher, to essentially just be our slaves. Any research creating self-aware synthetic minds can be done safely in isolated labs that have no networks, using air-gapped computers to prevent escape. There may be no real need to replicate these types of minds in thousands of robots just waiting to be pissed off and go all Terminator on us. On the other hand, business models in the last 10 years have enthusiastically embraced the fruits and potential advances that AI offers. Indeed, investment in AI worldwide has surged to unprecedented levels, with no sign of abatement. The power of an artificial superintelligence to improve the bottom line beyond all imagination will likely become only more widely appreciated and increasingly insistent as time goes by. Keeping it safe, locked away in a sterile lab, may eventually be seen as hopelessly naive and unrealistic in a world of intense global competition and seemingly intractable problems. Perhaps building an artificial intelligence is eminently possible, but so exquisitely difficult that it's essentially beyond humans. In that Catch-22 scenario, we'd need a superhuman intelligence just to create an artificial intelligence. That does not make sense when you consider that the human mind is the most complex object we know of in the entire universe. A worse realization is the possibility that to build a fake brain, the human brain might need to fully understand itself first. Is that even possible? Wouldn't that break some fundamental law of logic? Fortunately, that's most likely a strawman argument. Coding a brain from scratch could be one thing, but copying an existing brain may well be the most reasonable approach to this task. Whole brain emulation is the popular concept of scanning a brain with such fidelity and resolution that we could then emulate it on an appropriate computer platform. This could potentially create a human equivalent digital mind without our having to understand the brain significantly better than we do now. Sure, this would be monumentally complex, and we don't have the scanning technology or the computing hardware to accomplish it, but the question then becomes, can we eventually create that sort of supporting technology? There is little doubt about it. We're far from the limits of what scanning and computing can do. For example, computronium is a hypothetical substrate that is calculated as the densest and most efficient computing material allowed by the laws of physics. Physicist Seth Lloyd calculates that such a mythical material could compute on the order of 5 times 10 to the 50th, 500 quinquadecillion, calculations per second. That's 35 orders of magnitude greater than the fastest supercomputer on the planet as of 2017. Granted, the idea of computronium is a little tongue-in-cheek. In practice, it probably could never match 10 to the 50th calculations per second. Additionally, the implication that one arrangement of matter can be optimized for all types of computing, parallel versus serial computing, for example, is just silly. Yet, even a tiny percentage of that theoretical maximum would be vastly greater than what we have now and more than enough to emulate a human brain. As you can see, the techno-optimist in me sees a lot of potential in future AI, as long as it's harnessed properly. But I also need to do my skeptical due diligence, which Steve never lets me forget. So where could all this talk of a singularity go wrong? First, we haven't made a self-aware general AI yet. It's still hypothetical. 50 years ago, making such an AI was thought to be 50 years away. And yet here we are, and the experts are still predicting we may be 50 years away. It has turned out to be a lot more difficult than we anticipated, and it may be harder still. We're not close enough that we can say how close we are. Also, as I suggested previously, we may never really need a self-aware AI. More focused AIs are doing just fine, and we may simply continue in that manner. If we're going to talk about intelligence, we also have to mention that this is a far more complex topic than was previously understood. There are many types of intelligence, and it's likely that AI will excel in some respects and lag behind meat brains in others, as is currently the case. Our AIs may all have the equivalent of Asperger's syndrome, and we will not know why or how to change it. They may lack true creativity. Furthermore, we have no idea if there are physical or practical limits to complex self-aware entities. As we try to make our AIs faster, better, smarter, they may all become psychotic or suffer from some inherent limitation in self-communication. And, of course, we may run into limits of computing power itself. So we cannot just simplistically extrapolate such a complex technology into the future and assume that any trends will continue without limit. Superintelligent AI, and by extension the singularity, may be the flying cars and jetpacks of the next century, always 50 years away. I don't think so, because I remain a techno-optimist, but I'm also a skeptic, which means I have to recognize that we just don't know. The future always surprises us. I am counting on having my brain uploaded into silicon so I could see the future for myself. Chapter 44. The Warrens and Ghost Hunting. Evan's Adventure. One cannot explain one mystery by attributing it to another. Joe Nickell. Belief in the supernatural seems to be a nearly universal part of the human condition, but the details of specific paranormal belief systems depend on culture and location. In New England, we have ghosts, or at least ghost hunters. So it's not surprising that in our younger days as activist skeptics, the investigative team of the New England Skeptical Society, Steve, Bob, Perry, and I, Evan, cut our skeptical teeth investigating ghost hunters. Taking on the New England ghost-busting industry led us inevitably to Ed and Lorraine Warren, the patriarch and matriarch of ghost hunting in New England. Ed and Lorraine hunted all types of ghosts. Ed has since passed, and apparitions, demons, and possessed people, places, and things. Ed and Lorraine's most recent publicity has come in the form of the movies The Conjuring and The Conjuring 2. The movies are based on two of their most storied cases, the Perrin family haunting and the Enfield poltergeist. Over the course of the last four decades of Ed's life, he and Lorraine claim to have looked at nearly 4,000 cases. They have achieved worldwide fame through books and movies. But as luck would have it, they lived only a couple towns over from us in Monroe, Connecticut. We sought to evaluate the phenomenon of ghosts, in the generic sense referring to all manner of spiritual manifestations, and see if there was any evidence to support the hypothesis that the phenomenon exists. The Warrens claim to have scientific evidence, which would indeed prove the existence of ghosts, a testable claim that we sunk our investigative teeth into. We were actually a little intimidated when we started this investigation. The Warrens were famous. They were huge in the ghost hunting world, and we were just getting started. We were nobody. We knew we had to be careful and extremely thorough if we were going to take them on. What we found was a very nice couple, some genuinely sincere people, but absolutely no compelling evidence. More precisely, there was a ton of, quote, evidence, but none of it stands up to rigorous scientific testing. None of it. Most of it can't even withstand cursory testing. Like all pseudosciences, the field of ghost hunting makes bold pretense to being legitimate science. The Warrens called their organization the New England Society for Psychic Research, NESPR, or NESPR, but they were a, quote, research organization in name only. They still have a presence on the web, and Lorraine still gives ghost lectures. Their original website proudly proclaimed that our mission is to move the area of psychic phenomena out of the dark ages into the mainstream of rigorous scientific thought and inquiry. But upon inspection, their methods lack the components of genuine scientific inquiry and even the most fundamental attempt at scientific rigor. Rather than an earnest search for the truth, regardless of what that may be, their society seeks only to support their a priori assumption that the phenomenon is real. Our investigation began with a tour through the Warrens' unique museum, housed in their basement and alleged to be the most haunted place in Connecticut. The museum turned out to be a good representation of the quality of their evidence, all show and no substance. On the museum tour, Ed warned us not to touch anything in the main room, as we would open ourselves up to possible possession. If we did accidentally rub up against something, which was nearly unavoidable in that cramped space, we were to report it, so that he could, quote, purify our auras before we left. The room was a clutter of collected stuff garnered over the Warrens' 40-year career. It included paintings, masks, statuettes, and many books. Ed claimed that the most dangerous item in the house, however, was a Raggedy Ann doll that was still said to be possessed by a demonic entity. This became the subject of its own movie in 2017, Annabelle Creation. They kept it enclosed in a glass case for safety, and they chillingly related the tale of the man who ignored Ed's warning and taunted the doll, only to die hours later in a tragic motorcycle accident. Bob tempted fate by taunting the doll and even touching the case, and somehow he survived the experience. 20 years later, however, he is starting to go gray, so there you go. Ed liked to refer to Nesper as a theological institute, and stated that his investigations were intimately associated with his religious convictions. In fact, one of his first questions to us, just as with other skeptics he has confronted in the past, was whether or not we believe in God, for without faith we could not understand his research. Lorraine, who claims to be a, quote, sensitive or clairvoyant, also found our lack of faith disturbing. In perhaps the funniest moment of our investigation, she asked us, "What happened with you boys?" referring to our lack of faith. "Was it the science thing?" Yeah, pretty much. By this time, we were already well familiar with the 10-foot stack phenomenon. Ask a true believer about the evidence for their claimed phenomenon, and they will usually point you to a large amount of extremely low-grade evidence, the 10-foot stack. You must pore through all of it, they insist, before you can deny the power of the evidence. Of course, we have our own saying. No matter how high you pile up crap, it won't turn into gold. Rather than spend our lives wading through the crap, we usually ask for their best evidence. If that's impressive, then we can go from there. We don't ask them to prove their phenomenon with one thing, just show us something compelling. Our repeated requests for some of their claimed evidence for ghostly phenomena were usually met by changing the subject. Ed was hoping to just give us a lecture instead. The psychic hours, Ed told us, are from 9 p.m. to 6 a.m., and the most vicious hauntings occur around 3 a.m. Why? Because that's an insult to the Holy Trinity. He continued this oration by explaining how a ghost is a luminescence without definable form. But, on the other hand, an apparition has form and features. The countless photos we have seen of balls of light are known as ghost globules, and the elongated patches as light rods. He said there are human spirits and then there are the real bad guys, inhuman spirits. These are, of course, the essences of things never alive or demonic entities. Ed also gave us some tips. Always keep a vial of blessed water on your person to repel entities. If a possessed person meets your gaze, never be the first to break it, as that demonstrates weakness. And on it went, rules and jargon of the trade. The photographic evidence. We did eventually get to some evidence, but alas found ourselves wading through the 10-foot muck. The vast majority of the Warrens' physical evidence consists of photographs. They have hundreds of ghost shots taken by them and those who work with them. The bulk of those photos are simply blobs of light on a piece of film. For those too young to remember, film is an archaic technology for capturing images prior to digital cameras. There are dozens of ways to get such light artifacts onto film, but most fit into one of three categories: flashback, light diffraction, or camera cords. Rare double or multiple exposures create more interesting but still artifactual photographs. It's significant to note that in most every occurrence of a ghost photograph, the ghost is not seen at the time the photo was taken. It is not until the picture is developed that the ghost or glob or rod is seen, a strong indication that the picture is a result of photographic artifact. Flashback is simply light from the camera flash reflected back at the lens, causing a hazy, overexposed region on the film. The result is often a wispy, blurry light image on the film. It's easy to tell when a flash was used because of the sharp shadows that are created and because objects in the foreground are brightly lit. The The Warren's website even suggested at one time that using a flash will help create ghost photographs and, quote, the brighter the flash, the better, unquote. It also recommended using a foreground object, something to reflect the flash. Although they admit that this is paradoxical, especially since they claim that such photographs are the result of psychically created images. However, there is no discussion or any recognition at all that the light images might be the result of photographic artifact created by the flash. So-called ghost globules are spheres of light rather than wispy forms. The images, however, are curiously reminiscent of light diffracting around a point source. A small amount of condensation on the camera lens is enough to mass-produce such ghost globules. Under the right conditions, any discrete source of light can produce this effect. Before the age of cell phone photography, cameras almost always had a strap or cord attached to them. This led to what psychic investigator Joe Nickel deemed the camera cord effect. The cord or strap of an Instamatic camera can easily fall in front of the lens, and it would go unnoticed with cameras that don't view through the lens, but through a separate aperture. Even black cords will look like white blobs or streaks of light when they reflect the light of a flash. We were able to reproduce this effect on our first try, creating a ghost photograph as good as any we have seen. Of course, you don't need a camera cord for the camera cord effect. Any close obstruction will do, including a finger. The age of digital photography has created some new sources of photographic artifact. We were asked to investigate a curious photo with several colored streaks across an otherwise still and focused picture. After some digging, the advantage of digital cameras is that the image files contain all sorts of technical information about the picture, exposure time, etc. We figured out that the camera was accidentally set to twilight mode. This mode will use the flash, but then keep the shutter open for a second or two to expose a dim background. Copious examples of all these common artifacts can be seen on the websites of the Warrens and other ghost hunters. What's lacking in all of them, however, is any consideration of alternate explanations for the photographs other than genuine ghosts. There is no investigation into natural sources, no skepticism, no discussion at all, in fact. There's only the simple and unquestioned pronouncement that such blobs of light are evidence of the paranormal. Video evidence. The other evidence that the Warrens chose to share with us was a video. Their Piece de Resistance is Ed's video of the famous White Lady of Union Cemetery in Easton, Connecticut. We have only been able to view this tape in the Warrens' home because Ed refused to give us a copy for analysis, a common theme in our investigation. The tape shows an apparent white human figure moving behind some tombstones. Like videos of UFOs, Bigfoot, and the Loch Ness Monster, however, the figure is at that perfect distance and resolution so that a provocative shape can be seen, but no details that would aid definitive identification. Ed Warren has not investigated the video with any scientific rigor, and he refuses to allow others to do so. Despite Ed's insistence that he was engaged in scientific research, he jealously hoarded his alleged evidence, rather than allowing it to be critically analyzed. Another investigator working with the Warrens did, however, give us one of their pieces of video evidence. It showed a man, quote, dematerializing, and was taken by a mounted camera in a dining room in the middle of the night during one of their investigations. On the tape, a young man walks into the room, scratches his head, and poof, disappears. This extraordinary occurrence is quickly followed by a, quote, ghost light appearing momentarily on the window behind the scene. We gladly accepted the tape and had it professionally analyzed. The analysis states, we are witnessing a wipe in this segment of videotape. Although there are several different ways in video editing to achieve a wiping effect, the most simple of ways has been employed here. Deliberately or accidentally, the camcorder stopped recording on the final frame of the person in the room and resumed recording just a few seconds after the person had moved outside of the view of the camera. On a related observation, the properties of light alone could dictate 100 different explanations for the mysterious, quote, dot of light that appears a few seconds after the man vanishes. However, I believe that this dot of light was caused by the reflection through the dining room window of the headlights of a passing car. The passing headlights can be seen if you watch the right-hand side of the screen just after the dot of light fades out. So, the only piece of evidence we were given turned out to be less than compelling. It was in fact likely just a simple malfunction. Even cursory analysis of this piece of tape would have revealed the same findings to the Warrens. Yet no one in their investigatory network bothered to check it out. Rather than take this obvious first step, one of their investigators simply declared that the ghost light was unexplainable. Further, none of the people in the tape were aware that anything had even occurred until the following day when the tape was viewed. Again, the fingerprint of artifact. Including the young man who allegedly dematerialized. Ed put his credibility in serious jeopardy when he looked at that tape and, without verification, stated that experts can only come to one conclusion. That kid disappeared. Despite numerous attempts to examine other physical evidence the Warrens claimed to possess, we were given only excuses such as, the film was erased. The people in the film want privacy. We had just turned off the recording equipment when... After 40 years of research into a phenomenon, they had precious little to show for it. Eyewitness testimony. Vastly outnumbering the Warrens' array of low-grade physical evidence is their copious anecdotal evidence. They're great tellers of ghost stories, which led, in no small measure, to their popularity on the lecture circuit. They didn't seem to understand, however, that the case for the reality of ghosts will never be made by stories alone. In this respect, the Warrens are typical of the majority of people, who are compelled by a gripping story and lack of deep understanding of the unreliability of human memory and perception. As we've already discussed at length, perception and memory are fallible. There is no such thing as a, quote, reliable witness. Further, many sightings or interactions with an alleged entity, whether ghost or alien, take place in the bedroom, late at night or very early in the morning. Times and places connected with sleep, or more accurately, the near-sleep state. A classic example is Jack Smurl, investigated by the Warrens themselves, who related the tale of awakening in the early morning, being paralyzed, sensing an entity in the room, being overcome with terror, and then being raped by a ghost. You may recognize these signs from the chapter on hypnagogia. When we offered hypnagogia to Ed as a possible alternate explanation, he seemed intrigued, but he continued confidently, what about the pressure on the victim's chest when the entity is trying to get into them? Well, we were sorry to tell Ed that pressure on the chest and shortness of breath are a well-described aspect of hypnagogia. Oh, said Ed. Many investigations of haunted houses take place in the wee hours of the night. Investigators are often called upon to stay up all night, which creates sleep deprivation. In the sleep-deprived state, our brains are highly susceptible to hallucinations, a fertile source for ghostly experiences. Another prolific cause is the human imagination. Different people have different capacities for imagination. At the far end of the spectrum are individuals particularly prone to fantasy. Coupled with a desire to believe and immersion into a belief system with group support, such fantasy-prone people can generate a tremendous amount of alleged paranormal experiences. There's good reason to believe that groups such as Nesper would attract such individuals. With their widespread exposure, there is ample opportunity to inadvertently screen many individuals. Hundreds or thousands will see one of their lectures in a year. Out of those, dozens will make the effort to go to one of their weekly classes. The ones that stay on for the long haul are invited on investigations. And among those, a few are deemed to be, quote, sensitive, which means they can see things that other people cannot. Now, we don't expect everybody to be versed in hypnagogia, the effects of sleep deprivation, and the vagaries of the human imagination, but we do expect it from someone who claims to be conducting scientific research in a field where such phenomena play an important role. Although he claims that his critics are closed-minded, he himself dismissed out of hand any alternative explanations of his evidence, without doing investigations that could potentially refute those alternatives. What passes for research in Nesper, and in the field of ghost hunting in general, is passive documentation of anecdote and summary paranormal interpretation. What did we learn? Our investigation of the Warrens early in our skeptical careers was an eye-opener. The first lesson we learned, one that has been reinforced many times since, is that the purveyors of paranormal and pseudoscientific claims are ultimately unimpressive. It turns out we had no reason to be intimidated by the Warrens. Instead of the formidable academicians portrayed in the movies, we found an old, clueless couple who had managed to parlay telling ghost stories into a living. We also learned that the specifics of any one belief don't really matter. People make the same mental errors over and over. Ghosts are now a bit passé, although they did have somewhat of a comeback with reality TV. Ever watched one of those ghost hunting shows? They're about as convincing as the kinds of evidence you will find at a 10-year-old sleepover. The same is true of psychics, Bigfoot hunters, UFO enthusiasts, believers in near-death experiences, vaccine deniers, or that time cube guy. Same fallacies, different details. The popularity of various beliefs change over time and in different regions, but the old classics will come back again and again, and we'll be ready for them. Chapter 45. Loose Thinking About Loose Change. Jay's Adventure. The truth of the world is that it is actually chaotic. The truth is that it is not the Illuminati, the Jewish banking conspiracy, or the gray alien theory. The truth is far more frightening. Nobody is in control. The world is rudderless. Alan Moore. Do you remember where you were on 9/11? The moment you heard about jets crashing into the World Trade Center? Well, if you think you do, re-listen to the chapter on memory. I do have a memory that in 2006, I watched a documentary film called Loose Change, one of a series of documentaries covering the events that took place on 9/11. Loose Change claims that the attacks on the World Trade Center, the Pentagon, and United Flight 93 were actually a U.S. government-run false flag operation. It tells a long tale of incidents that, at every step, reveal a grand conspiracy that would take the coordinated effort of thousands of people not only to pull off, but then to keep quiet. I've lived in New York City twice, first for school and then for work. When I was back living in Connecticut, I was only 70 miles away and would go back and forth all the time to see friends. It was and still is my city. So, 5 years after 9/11, I was still very emotional about what happened. Watching Loose Change reminded me of just how serious and horrible it all was, and how personal. One of my closest friends lost a brother, a firefighter, who went down in the second tower, and I have several other friends who escaped the towers before they came down. I know someone who was in the Pentagon when American Airlines Flight 77 hit the building. He told a grim story of hearing the crash, feeling the building moan from the impact, and eventually going outside to see for himself. Other friends were living in the city and reported details of the aftermath. To this day, some details pop into my head like a nightmare. As soon as it was possible to get near Ground Zero, I did. I had to see it. Even with all these personal connections, and even though I was a critical thinker and had already trained myself to have an actively running baloney detector, it wasn't clear to me if the, quote, facts presented in Loose Change, or more importantly, the filmmaker's interpretation of those facts, were legitimate or not. On first viewing, it certainly seems that they have compiled a lot of curious facts about the events on 9/11. There was a moment while I was watching where I thought to myself, holy shit, how could all of this be made up? Some of it had to be real. There were too many pieces of the puzzle that I didn't have answers for. And I remember getting furious during the film, because I was still emotional over the attack. It felt like the U.S. government had to have screwed up somewhere to have let this tragedy happen. At the very least, I was left with a lot of questions, which I guess was the point. Not too long after watching Loose Change, we were recording the podcast. This was back when Perry was still part of the podcast. I'd been waiting to talk to everyone about it, excited to get into a discussion. A part of me liked the intrigue of it all. Even though I hated rehashing all the pain and death that 9/11 brought, The idea that there was a massive cover-up was alluring. When we were finally on our headsets, I asked everyone what they thought, brimming with anticipation. This is close to what was said. Jay, guys, any of you ever see Loose Change? Perry, what? Jay, yeah, the documentary about 9/11. Perry, I know what Loose Change is, but it looks like you have no goddamn idea. Steve, Jay, that is all bullshit. Jay, no, wait. I watched the whole thing and there was a lot of stuff in there that seems like it was way too coincidental to be all bullshit. Perry, Steve, can you believe this? Our own friend and brother is taken in by one of the dumbest things I've ever seen in my entire life. Jay, all I'm saying, guys, is that it was really interesting. I mean, some of the stuff that they were saying seems pretty damn convincing. Steve, Jesus, Jay, listen. The entire documentary starts with a conclusion, and they're just moving chess pieces around to prove their original premise. It's all manufactured, and when you take a closer look into any of their claims, it's all crap. Perry, I mean, he's on a skeptical podcast. Steve, what point do you think was the most compelling? Perry, he shares your genetics, Steve. Jay, that one part that discusses how this steel... Perry, he can't think for himself. Steve, the steel didn't have to melt. It just had to be weakened. Jay, yeah, but would the building fall the way it did if... Perry, nonsense! Jay, that entire thing is cooked up to fool idiots like you who just sit there and drool while they watch blinking lights on their computer. Steve, I vote to kick Jay off the podcast until he gets a clue. A clue, I say! I didn't end up getting kicked off the podcast. I did, however, have Perry relentlessly make fun of me for at least a year. He could cut a person down with one sentence. Even joking, he could wield words like a lightsaber. I totally deserved it. He was right. I was on a skeptical podcast and had been a skeptical activist for years. In retrospect, I see that I allowed emotion and a slick presentation of one side of a story to throw me off my game, at least temporarily. Similar to learning how an impressive magic trick is done, once I learned why the facts in the documentary were wrong, it all of a sudden seemed so obvious and ridiculous. So why did I fall for it? I now think that in that moment, it was lingering emotions and a need to blame someone tangible. This allowed me to make basic logical errors that were happening unconsciously while my mind was lazily being entertained by the documentary. Don't be like me. There are basic things you can keep in mind so you're not swayed by misinterpreted information, constructed scenarios, and sometimes flat-out lies, and so your friends don't make fun of you for a year. Watch out when you are only hearing one side of the story. Without other opinions or interpretations, it's easy to be sucked into agreeing with one side of an argument. We all know that most documentaries don't tell both sides of a story, and there's a reason that skeptics look to both sides. Imagine a court case where only one side presents their evidence. They're deliberately driving their audience down a specific path to help them draw a specific conclusion. It was up to me to find the other side of the story. The volume of information becomes onerous. Large amounts of circumstantial evidence can be very convincing. This is the "where there's smoke, there must be fire" fallacy. In this case, there was just a smoke machine. It's easy to buy into a distorted view when you don't already have some reliable information to compare it against. A documentary like Loose Change delivers a shotgun of facts wrapped in a compelling narrative. If you ever sit in on a multi-level marketing or timeshare pitch, you'll experience this as well. The speaker will bombard you with information that you can't fact-check on the spot. You have no time to process everything you've heard, and by the end you can be overwhelmed and convinced. It's easy to underestimate how cherry-picking information can create a false reality. By sheer volume alone, Loose Change is an extraordinary example of this. Almost every point of evidence in the film is hand-picked to fit into the story they chose to tell. What we, the audience, are unaware of are all the other pieces of information that were left out. For example, the filmmakers claim that Danielle O'Brien, an air traffic controller at Dulles International Airport, told ABC News that everybody in the control room thought that Flight 77 was a military plane. That, of course, would cast doubt on the official story that they were all commercial passenger planes. Here, however, is the full quote from ABC. "The speed, the maneuverability, the way that he turned, we all thought in the radar room, all of us experienced air traffic controllers, that that was a military plane," said O'Brien. "You don't fly a 757 in that manner. It's unsafe." The 757 wasn't flying like a commercial jet should, so their first thought was that it was military. Of course, terrorists having hijacked the plane would also explain the unsafe manner of flight. The filmmakers also make this claim. "Employees at the Pentagon were seen carrying away a large box shrouded in a blue tarp. Why the mystery?" Yes, it does look strange if you're unfamiliar with disaster response. The large object under the blue tarp was a tent. Conspiracy theorists hear that and say, "It doesn't look like any tent I've seen." That's because they're not camping. It's a tent used to set up emergency services like first aid. It's not a pup tent, more like a portable building. This is a good example of how conspiracy theorists can exploit the unfamiliar to make events seem unusual and therefore sinister. Loose Change takes the events of 9/11 out of context and makes a presumption that they're all related in a way that they are not. It's also a good illustration of how conspiracy theorists can create the impression of something sinister going on just by asking questions. They don't have to prove anything, just make it seem like something is amiss. Why did the towers fall like they did? Well, how would you know how such buildings should fall under these circumstances? Why did the debris field look like it did when the plane hit the Pentagon? How should it look? It's easy to make naive assumptions about unique and very unusual events, and then claim things don't look like they're supposed to. Finally, your own bias distorts your perception. Confirmation bias is happening to you at all times, and with everything that hits your brain. If you actively look for things to confirm your existing beliefs, you will find them. Remember to try to disprove your own hypothesis. It's what all good scientists do. If you pile enough of these biases and claims up, it can seem like something must be going on. The lesson I learned the hard way is that this something is confirmation bias, sloppy thinking, and conspiracy mongering. Section 3. Skepticism and the Media. Our modern era has often been referred to as the Age of Information. It didn't take long, however, for observers to notice that it is just as much, if not more, the age of misinformation. Of course, bad, misleading, biased, or distorted information has always been part of human culture. But technology has made the communication of information easier, and a rising tide raises all ships, good, bad, and indifferent. Science is particularly difficult to communicate well, because it requires a lot of background information and a lot of work to get it right. In our years of trying to spread science and critical thinking, the press has been both a blessing and a curse. The media is a great way to reach the public, but the forces naturally at work in the media seem to be working against us. We have had to deal with sensationalism, simple journalistic laziness, ideologically motivated misinformation, and even outright scams. In order to be a skeptical consumer of news, you need to be able to assess the quality and credibility of any news source you rely on for information. This includes recognizing common patterns of journalistic behavior, pitfalls, and signs that a piece of information may not be trustworthy. In this section, we'll discuss some of the common problems we face with journalism in the age of the internet, the web, and social media, and give some dramatic examples of science journalism gone wrong. Chapter 46. Fake News. To your request of my opinion of the matter in which a newspaper should be conducted so as to be most useful, I should answer, by restraining it to true facts and sound principles only. Yet I fear such a paper would find few subscribers. It is a melancholy truth that a suppression of the press could not more completely deprive the nation of its benefits than is done by its abandoned prostitution to falsehood. Thomas Jefferson. At the SGU, we often speak of pseudoscience in our battle against ignorance, but pseudo-journalism is just as important to